Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today on Terra Madre Day. My guest is actually going to be the Slow Food International Vice President, Edward Mukhidi. And it's just so appropriate to have him on today since it is the International Terra Madre Day, which is a day of celebration of our local food traditions and biodiversity through the slow food movement. And our local slow food chapter is actually having a holiday party and celebration of Terra Madre Day on December 15th. And that's going to be at Danielle's Kitchen in Northport. So if you're around and available, we'd love to have you join us on December 15th for our Slow Food North Shore holiday party and Terra Madre celebration. There's lots of great things going on in around the city that I'm going to share with you, along with a great recipe for Hanukkah, which we are in the middle of. And then I'll be inviting Edward on in just a little bit. So first, as I said, today's Terra Madre Day, and I hope you can find something locally to celebrate your local food tradition and just think about Mother Earth in everything that you do, and celebrate eating locally. And make sure that whatever you're eating is good for your body, good for the planet, and good for you, the Earth. December 11th, tomorrow night, is the monthly Friday night dinner at the Natural Gourmet Institute, and this one on December 11th is benefiting the Just Food organization, and it's a locally inspired three-course menu with wine pairings, and a portion of the $65 ticket fee will be going towards the Just Food organization. December 14th, Slow Food New York City is having their happy hour called the Manhattan Slur, and this one will be at Rosso Pomodoro on Greenwich Avenue from 7 to 9. December 30th, Michael Pollan's documentary screening of In Defense of Food is going to be free on PBS. That's Wednesday, December 30th at 9 p.m. So I have not seen this film yet, but I know Food Inc. was amazing, and I'm sure this one will be too. So try to catch that if you can. January 22nd to the 24th is the 2016 NOFA New York Winter Conference. That's always an unbelievable weekend of information. And you can go for one day, you can go for the whole weekend, and you can register right on the NOFA New York website. And lots of other great things going on, but I want to share a recipe with you. This is a potato latkes recipe and also a sweet potato latkes recipe, which is vegan and gluten-free. So I'm just going to go through the regular potato latkes quickly and then spend a little more time on the vegan one because that's a little bit more unusual. So the potato latkes, I use 1 cup of unbleached white flour, 4 organic onions cut into slivers, 12 organic potatoes, grated, and then you squeeze the water out, 4 organic eggs, 1 tablespoon salt, and oil for frying. But you can also bake them. I should just let you know that if you grease a cookie sheet and put them in an oven at 450 degrees, a hot oven, and turn them over halfway through, you can do that too, and they're a little less oily. Still delicious. So in a large bowl, you're going to make a batter with the eggs, flour, and salt. Then add the onions and potatoes. Mix thoroughly. And then I drop them by spoonfuls. I actually use my hand, and I just pick up a little pinch and drop it into the deep fryer skillet with some hot oil. I don't form them into patties. I really like the free form, and when the onions and the potatoes are sticking out in little pieces, that's all parts that get more crunchy, and they're really, really delicious. And I make a homemade applesauce with that. I use 6 apples along with some cinnamon, 1/4 cup of water, and a little maple syrup or honey if you want to sweeten it at all. That's optional. And you just peel, core, and slice the apples, and then put them into either a slow cooker or a pot with just a little bit of water or apple juice and the cinnamon and the maple syrup, and just cook it. Bring it to a boil and lower the heat to simmer, and cook it for about 10 minutes, and voila, you have applesauce. Really easy and really delicious. And now the vegan and gluten-free ones, I add some sweet potatoes to this, and some carrots. So it's not just potato and onion. It also has some sweet potato and carrot in it. So it has a nice little orange color. And instead of white flour, I'm using chickpea flour, also known as Bissan flour. You can use another gluten-free flour if you like as well, but the chickpea flour is perfect, and it gives a really nice flavor. So start with a half a cup of Bissan flour, a quarter teaspoon of baking soda, which takes the place of the eggs, gives it a little levity, 5 tablespoons cold water, 1 small onion cut into slivers, 1 potato grated with the water squeezed out, 1 sweet potato grated, and 1 carrot grated, 1 teaspoon salt, 1 teaspoon chopped parsley, which is optional, depending on whether your group would like little pieces of green in it or not. I think it adds beautiful color, and I love the flavor, but sometimes, you know, people don't like green. So anyway, in a large bowl, you're going to make a batter with the chickpea flour, the baking soda, and the water. Then add all the vegetables, and again, you're going to drop it by spoonfuls into the deep fryer, or again, you can bake it in a 450-degree oven. You can line a cookie sheet with some parchment paper, and spray that with oil, and then drop it by spoonfuls onto the baking sheet and bake it at 450 for 10 minutes. And turn it over halfway through and bake it for another 5 minutes. Either way, these are both really great, delicious recipes. And while we're in the middle of Hanukkah, making some potato latkes is really traditional for Hanukkah and is really a wonderful thing to do. So make some potato latkes, enjoy your Hanukkah, and we're going to take just a couple-minute break, and when I come back, I will have my guest, Edward Mukabi, with me. Be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm so happy to have with me today my guest, Edward Mukabi. He is the Vice President of Slow Food International and an agronomist from Uganda. And welcome, Eddie. How are you?
I'm good. I'm happy to be here with you.
Thank you. Well, I'm so happy to have you here. I know you have a full-packed trip here in New York and the States while you're here. After New York, you're going to Detroit, New Orleans, right, and then California?
Yes, and also in Mississippi, and lastly in California, in Sacramento.
Ah, great, great. Well, I have lots of questions that I know I'm interested in and my listeners are interested in, but first I wanted to just ask you to share your story. Can you share with us how you got involved with the slow food movement and came to be Vice President of Slow Food International?
Thank you so much. The story is long, and it dates back in 2008 when I was an upcoming young agronomist. I worked with the communities in Uganda, and there are so many new varieties of crops that come up and promoted and given to the producers to start producing, because many times seed companies are looking at yield, and they do a lot of persuasive advertisement for these super hybrid crops. And as a young agronomist, I worked with the communities to promote the growth of different crops, and the turn of events happened in 2008. In 2007, when the late part of the year, the unexpected rain, the rains expected didn't turn up, and there was a little bit of strong drought in many parts of the country, and many farmers lost their crops, especially those who had adopted the hybrid maize and planted many of their crops in a monoculture or in a pure stand. When I went back as a person who used to work with them, when I went back to talk to them, I found something is missing. I found these people who had lost mostly almost 100 of their crop in a pure stand, very, very miserable, and something was wrong with the system they used to produce. They explained to me that if it was their traditional system, they would have remained with some of the crops, because The African traditional system involves planting, for example, especially in central Uganda or parts of western Uganda. It involves planting different crops because you're never certain what will happen in the future.
Right, so if one crop doesn't work, you can fall back on another one.
Yes, if one crop fails, you fall back on another one, right. Or even two fail, there is always another choice. Right. But this time, working in a monocultural system makes you lose almost all the crop. And talking to the producers, I felt their pain. I felt what they were going through. And then I started working with them to go back to the mixed farming, the diversified way of farming, the farming system that promotes biodiversity, that values the importance of symbiotic relationship between the different crops which are grown by the producers. So working with these producers made me understand a lot of things about the ecosystem. And I wanted to reach out to many other organizations which are promoting similar kind of system, the food system, which doesn't depend on a single crop, which doesn't depend on, which doesn't only think about putting food on the market or buying seeds and plant and produce. So I searched for organizations, I searched for people I could partner with to support these producers, rediscover biodiversity and diversification on their farms. And here I came across Slow Food and Terra Madre. And I realized that I was not alone fighting to change things. Slow Food was already working a lot in different countries, was working worldwide, and I joined Slow Food. In 2008, I was invited to attend the Terra Madre edition in Turin, where I met a lot of people, a lot of energetic, a lot of active people working to change the food system, promoting biodiversity, preserving traditions, sharing knowledge. People who valued their traditional knowledge. And this is how I got so much involved with Slow Food. I came back to Uganda. I started the first, I started the Convivium. There was already some people who had attended the previous editions of Terra Madre. I started talking to them how we need to strengthen the Slow Food network in Uganda. I created the Convivium in my hometown in Mukono. I started involving more young people in this Convivium, talking to them about biodiversity, talking to them about the importance of traditional farming systems, the importance of supporting small-scale producers and eating local, as well as promoting diversified farms in mm-hmm. my area. Working with small-scale fishermen. Also, I continuing to work with the small gardens, with the school gardens, with the community gardens, with to share knowledge, to share ideas, to create new innovations, but that value our traditional farming mm-hmm. systems. So Mkono Convivium was created. I involved many young people. We started using innovations like community radios, mobile phones to communicate, to link up with the producers. And this is how I got so involved with Slow Food.
You know, looking at your bio, I was surprised to hear that they actually made you work in the garden as punishment when you were younger. And so it was like surprising to me that after that you would actually still want to follow, your passion in the garden. Because, you know, very often when something's used as punishment, it can turn you off to wanting to do it.
Growing up in a farming community, in a family which is traditionally a farming family, I went to school and I found this practice of using farming as a punishment. It always pained me, and I always wanted to change things, but I was still young. And yes, it was a big problem, but I always saw things differently. I this didn't mean I should sit back and also continue hat farming, because I continued all the years seeing my mother going to the garden. I always saw my parents go to farm, and I valued farming as an economic activity, especially for my family. And it's one of the wishes I made, that when I grow up, I want to see a change in this. And growing up, I got time, I got energy, I got space to find ways how I can change this. And I had to go back to my community, identify schools to start with. And I never wanted to make it confrontational, because I didn't want to create a fight in my old schools with my mm-hmm. old teachers. And that's why I started with working with the schools of very little children that had never ever used farming as a punishment. And I wanted to create a different world. To show them that with this different world compared to the world where farming is used as a punishment, we can find a solution by creating young people who love agriculture, by creating a generation of young people who value farming, by creating a generation of young people who produce food with love, with care, with respect to environment. And this worked out perfectly, because when we created the first garden I worked with in 2006, now with the children harvesting the vegetables, children harvesting the fruits, very little children with a lot of love, with a lot of interest, I started inviting these other schools where I went. Actually, I invited teachers and students from my former primary school, which was worse, using farming as a punishment. I invited them to come and meet this school, to come and be part of the parties, which we did with these children, and they liked it. They mm-hmm. said, "Oh, how can we join the program? How can we do something similar?" And now this, I got a chance to speak to them about stop to use farming as a punishment, about encouraging young people to go to the garden with their own initiative, with interest, with love, to give them a chance to plan a garden, to start a garden, to manage a garden, and also to take care of it from their own wisdom.
Now, at the beginning of the interview, you touched on the fact that there were a lot of corporations coming in, having people in your area start planting monocrops. And, we hear a lot about land grabbing and big corporations trying to take over the land in parts of Africa. Is land grabbing what you're talking about, and what is being done right now to minimize the influence that big corporations have with, using the monocrops and the genetically modified crops, as opposed to going back to sustainable practices?
Talking about land grabbing, it's really happening in many countries in Africa. It's many times it's not something new. It's something which has been happening historically many years ago. And the big, rich corporations, the private investment from the rich countries in Europe, in Asia, also in the America here, they go through the corrupt political systems in our countries in Africa, and also they hide through in the international policies, which give our advocate for a free trade, which ask poor countries in the global south to give a free investment opportunity to these rich companies to invest in Africa. And in this case they get a lot of land which is almost free. The governments, the African governments, give away land for development purposes, and the land is used not only to grow crops but also for other activities. And we've seen many countries in Africa give up land the governments give land to private European companies, to private Chinese companies, to grow oil crops like soya, to grow jatropha, millions of hectares being grabbed and given away to these countries to grow monocrops, to totally destroy and change and destroy the ecosystem, to grow these different crops. And at first they promise a lot of development, they promise a lot of jobs, they promise a lot of things, infrastructure development to the communities, and the communities get so excited, the politicians get so excited, and in the end result is destruction of the communities. And you find a lot of outraged people, a lot of miserable communities. For example, countries where land grabbing is at a glance include Mozambique.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of land has been given away for production of soya. You go to West Africa, you find millions of hectares of land grabbed in Ghana. Also a lot of land grabbing in Ethiopia. This is something which is putting the food sovereignty and food security of many African countries at stake. And the environmental part of it, it involves a lot of destruction and too much chemical use because of the monocultural system, which is not tailored for the African environment.
It's not tailored for any environment.
And the biggest losers in this land grabbing are mainly women, because it forces men to move away, because first of all the promised jobs may not materialize, and men will move to the cities to find jobs because their land has been taken away. And women who have been working on this land, producing food for their families, now will be the biggest losers. They will stay there with abandoned, when the men abandon the families, they go to look for life anywhere else. And this is a very big threat to the food security and sovereignty in Africa. And there is also very well organized small-scale land grabbing taking place by big monocultural companies. I'll give an example of the case in Uganda. In 2007, there was a plan, a request by one of the big sugarcane companies to use the natural forest for sugar production, to cut down the biggest natural forest in Uganda for sugar production. And all
was
of us...
Was this a U.S. company?
No, it's an Indian family, but based in Uganda.
Uh-huh.
It's a huge, one of the biggest sugar producers in the country, sugarcane producers in the country. They requested the government to give away this forest to cultivate sugarcane, to boost sugar production, mm-hmm. and also to increase the export of sugar. And all of us, the environmental activists, opposed this deal. And it came that the opposition was very strong, and the sugarcane company dropped the deal, the request, out of the pressure we put up on the government. But again, now the what is happening is that the forest is going slowly because with money these the people around the forest are being asked to start growing sugarcane. The small scale producers around the forest are being asked to start growing sugarcane, and when they grow sugarcane, at first the price is very high per kilogram of sugarcane. And when these companies realize that you have converted all your land to sugarcane, the prices drop. And when the prices drop, you have no option but to still selling sugar to them. And now they come and ask you if you would like to lease your land and find land to produce food anywhere else in the forest. So when you accept, because they give you a very good offer,
right,
for you to give up your land, to go and clear part of the forest and grow your food in the forest. So when you give up your land, they add it to the sugarcane company. And when you move into the forest, cut down a small piece of the forest, and after years they follow up, they come and say, okay, we also give you money to
right, this, so this slowly but surely they're getting the this, forest anyway.
Yes, it's they it's happening like this, and it's not only in Uganda but also in many other countries. We saw it in Kenya with the clearance of the Mau forest by the tea companies. It's very, very strategically planned land grabbing, but it's something which is very, very which is a big threat to the future of food in Africa, to mm-hmm. the future of food production in Africa, because many times the activities which land grabbers do on the land doesn't directly benefit or add up to the future of food in the on the continent. It's just to produce biofuel, biodiesel,
right,
or to produce animal feeds to export to other continents, and also to do other activities like construction, like mining, like other things. And the losers are the African people.
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of stuff is happening all around the world, and organizations like Slow Food are really trying to raise awareness. And I think so much of that has to happen through education. Can you share with us how the project of Slow Food, the 10,000 gardens in Africa, how that is impacting gardens in Africa, both for women's opportunities and for school gardens?
The 10,000 Gardens in Africa project is a project that was born from within Africa, and it was started by us because we now, after all this turn of events, after all problems with land grabbing, problems with loss of biodiversity, the influx of new hybrid seeds, the threat, GMO threats, and also food sovereignty and security issues, which have been happening in the last couple of years, we need something to show to the world that African communities still have hope of feeding Africa with the small scale farming, with the small agriculture which we have, with our local and traditional seeds. Also building capacity of women in the rural places, building capacity of young people, involving more young people in food production. So we started this project for many reasons. First of all, the garden, and in the Slow Food Garden, in the 10,000 gardens in Africa, is not just a physical space where we grow vegetables, where people grow food, where people get fresh produce every season, but it's also a meeting point. It's a meeting place where old and young people meet to discuss the future of food, to discuss the food system in their local area. It's also a place where communities, where families, where schools test different local innovations as far as food production is concerned. It's also a place where we preserve our biodiversity. And also it's a political message about African desire to utilize our land as Africans. And in this we send a message of resistance to land grabbing through these gardens. Because now communities learn how to utilize and value their land. And with the small actions which are done in the gardens, they are a sign of giving hope to the families that with our local seeds, with our local varieties of vegetables, we can feed our families. With all this knowledge that is generated from these gardens is what we need as Africa to share, to blend with science. The traditional knowledge we get from the gardens, we need to blend it with science to sustain food production in our communities. And also young people to learn about the value of local biodiversity. This is all the message which come from the garden. It's not just a physical place where you meet, grow crops, and harvest and eat, but it carries a lot of value
mm-hmm.
to the community. And for the school, it involves a lot of young people talk to their teachers, and it involves a lot of extracurricular activities. You may find that this garden is very small. Most of our schools have like primary schools. On average, you find a primary school with 700 to 1,000 pupils with a very small garden. It may not be able to feed all the 1,000 pupils, but the knowledge and the multiplier effect from this small plot of land is what all these pupils need to take back home and support their families. And it's also a way to introduce interest of right. young people in sustainable agriculture. And when they learn about this, they go home with the knowledge. They work with their parents, happy to be producers, food producers, happy to share knowledge which they shared from other colleagues, from mm-hmm. other communities. And this is how we can move our food system.
Right. Well, the gardens, just like here as well, when we have school gardens, it doesn't feed everybody in the school, but it's an extended classroom. It's like an yeah. outdoor classroom where you can learn about sustainable agriculture. And
mm.
here in our country, so much of it is really about getting kids to even eat vegetables
mm.
because so often they don't want to try it. And we have found that if they grow it, they're much more likely to try it. So it benefits in that way too. One of the issues we've been dealing with or trying to raise awareness about in this country is also about food waste. And here in the States, most of the food waste is actually happening on the consumer level. But I have heard that in Africa, most of the food waste is happening more on the distribution level and getting the food out there. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and how you're working to try to remedy some of the distribution issues?
The issue of food waste, I look at it in two different ways. There is waste and also there is loss. So I'll start with the loss, because this is now the first point. When farmers are on the farm, they do a lot of work, donkey work, to bring food to life, to raise crops, to raise animals, to raise the different vegetables. And many times, living on a continent which lies broadly within the tropics, with a warm environment, warm temperatures, erratic rainfall seasons, sometimes prolonged droughts, farmers go through a lot of problems, a lot of challenges to raise this food, the crops and the animals. And you find that at the end of the growing season comes the harvest season. There is a lot of food we lose at the harvest and the post-harvest as producers. You find that during the harvest alone, like especially for the grains, like for the rice, you find that the harvesting methods are not that efficient. The harvesting methods have not been developed to efficiently take care of every single grain that has matured from the farmer's field. During harvest, farmers cut a lot of grains, harvest a lot of crops, and in that process of like transportation of the grains from the field to the collection centers, farmers lose a lot. And during the drying process, farmers lose a lot of grains because we don't have developed systems to keep every grain intact, to keep every product. I don't know if it's very clear, but we do have a lot of post-harvest losses, and also the storage facilities. In the past, traditionally, we used to have a lot of granaries where farmers would store their grains, but today the granary culture, especially in northeastern Uganda, where granaries was a big culture, you don't find a lot of them. You find where you find them, they are collapsing, and sometimes they are leaking, and in that case, the water destroy a lot of crops. And for me, I would not call this waste, because sometimes farmers have no choice. Where they have overwhelming yield, a farmer stays in a very small house and they don't have anywhere to store the grains. They don't have we have a lot of farmers who harvest a lot of vegetables, but they don't have cooling facilities or freezing, they can't freeze or keep these vegetables in the refrigerator for them to reach the next destination. In the end, the vegetables go bad, or they end up getting rotten. The same thing with the milk. We work a lot with the livestock producers. They produce a lot of milk, but it only takes 12 hours for 100 liters of milk to go bad. Because farmers in the most rural places, however much they labor so much to raise the cows, they harvest milk, they have meat, but they don't have these facilities to keep food at least for some time before it reaches the final destination. For me, I would not call this waste. I call it loss.
Right.
So we lose a lot of food in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And also...
But what's so hard is that whether you call it waste or loss, it's not just the product, but it's all that energy and time and labor that went into it for the farmer.
Yeah.
You know, so what, if anything, are you working towards doing to help remedy that? Or is slow food, are they able to help at all? Is it just the need of money, or is it governments too that are, you know, just explain it to me how we can...
One of the ways we are dealing with this as slow food through our different projects. Also, we deal with this problem in the 10,000 Gardens in Africa project by educating producers on post-harvest handling, and also value addition and transformation of the products. If we have vegetables, yes, we may not have cooling facilities, or we may not freeze these vegetables to the market quickly or easily, but there are many other options which we explore, like steaming the vegetables and solar drying the fruits. We go through a lot of options, and these are suggestions which we also collect from the producers themselves. We have like most of the fruits solar drying of the fruits, of the vegetables. We also, just to keep them for another day, just to keep them for few more days before they go bad. For the milk, we are working with the cattle producers, especially women who deal a lot with milk in communities, to explore value addition options for milk, like production of clarified butter. If instead of waiting for the milk to go bad, we are supporting women in communities to turn milk into other products like yogurt, like clarified butter, or what we call ghee. We have also the ghee sauce, which can stay for at least 6 months. Instead of waiting for the milk to go bad. These are things which we are trying to work with the communities, address these issues of post-harvest losses, and also reviving the granary culture in northeastern Uganda, where there is a lot of millet. Traditionally, northeastern Uganda, they produce a lot of millet, and we are working with the producers to train the old people have a lot of knowledge about constructing granaries, and this there is a knowledge gap between the old people and the young people. So we have meetings with the old people, come to schools to teach about the culture, the spirit of constructing granaries and storage of grains, and also quickly transform the grains to flour that can be much easily stored,
right,
and not easily destroyed by rodents. So these are things which we are work on. Then from these post-harvest losses, where most of the food produced in Africa fail to reach the consumer, again, we also, on top of that, we have this wasteful culture by the consumers. In the urban environments, in the cities, where people have developed a throwaway culture, producers take a lot of time to bring up a produce, a crop, for example, the potatoes, and when it reaches the town, you find a lot of food on the bin, in the bin, on the rubbish pits. You find a lot of vegetables being thrown away to the urban landfills, because just like here, there is also a lot of food waste at the consumer
right,
level,
right,
which is cropping up. It's growing up, and it's heartbreaking to see this kind of wasteful culture in a hungry world where we have still have a lot of hungry people. And how, as Slow Food, we are working with the Slow Food Youth Network to run a campaign against food waste in urban centers. For example, the young people under Slow Food, they go to the markets, they go to the shops, they go to the supermarkets and look out for vegetables which have not been bought, and they are going to be thrown away. And we do big events with these vegetables, like we have what we call the disco soup, where young people collect food which is destined for the bin, chop them and make soup out of it, eat with the community,
and have a big party.
I have a big party with these vegetables. And also, another problem with food waste is standardization, whereby now we have a system which teaches us that in the supermarket we only find a perfectly shaped carrot, a perfectly shaped cucumber, that an apple has to be of this size, and in the end you find that the crops which don't attain this standard size or shape are thrown away. But this remains food.
Right.
So it also starts with the education of the young people that this is equally important to eat, just like the perfect carrot.
Right, there's a big movement for that. Fruits and vegetables, you know.
So we are doing a lot of education in urban schools, in the urban communities, and also in the rural schools, in the rural communities on food waste. It starts with educating the consumers, and also on food losses, we are working a lot to educate the producers on post-harvest losses. And again, sometimes also on the food loss, you find the poorly developed infrastructural setup. Like many, I'll give an example of producers of potatoes in southwestern Uganda. During the season, you find a lot of potatoes produced in southwestern Uganda. Because it's the leading producer of potatoes in Africa, in Uganda. But this area is in a mountainous, cool environment where road transport is very difficult. And the potatoes mature during the rainy season.
Oh, no.
So it becomes very difficult to transport the potatoes from southwestern Uganda to places where they are needed, where they are required by the people, because during this period, mostly the rural roads are broken, the roads are slippery, the trucks cannot access the farms, and on top of that, farmers do not have developed systems of keeping these potatoes alive until when things get better. So you find farmers seated with tons and tons of rotting potatoes. And again, on the other side of the country, people are hungry. People need these potatoes. Right. So this is there is a very big problem with the distribution system. It leads to losses and also leads to waste because too much is sent to the cities because that's where money is.
Right.
And people start developing this wasteful culture because the distribution channel is like it's on one side. It's thinking about putting the food where there is money, and people will not always finish everything, mm-hmm. and they will end up throwing away a lot of stuff, right. thinking that there is a lot.
Now, with most of the countries in Africa, is your food system separate amongst countries, or is there a lot of cross-sharing in your food system? I mean, we have an industrial food system. Our country is so big. So, you know, I'm in New York and California, you know, in Africa, it's another country. Here, it's just another state. So how much of the food system is shared amongst the different countries?
What I will say is that there are so many similarities between countries in Africa. The food system of different countries in Africa. But we have a lot of also diversity in activities, in varieties, in crops, and also the production systems in many cases are different. Also, the fact that the environment, the climate, the weather, and the geography of different countries is also that we have different aspects of production. You find right. that there are countries which lie in the desert, on the desert side of Africa. They have a different production system
sure.
than different from the tropics, and also we have the Mediterranean part of Morocco. They have a different way, like approach to production. But in the countries like very close to the equator, in the equatorial part of Africa, you find a lot of similarities in crops, in the growing seasons. You find a lot of similarities in the methods of production, and also in the consumption methods uh-huh. or consumption models. Take an example of countries in East Africa. We share so many things in common with Kenya, with Rwanda, and also northern parts of Tanzania, where you find so many similarities mm-hmm. in climate, also in the crops grown. And what I will say is that most of the production systems in many countries in Africa is based on small-scale family farms.
Right.
Whereby, and the production is also dominated by women who produce most of the food in many countries in Africa. And most of the rain, food production is rain-fed. It's based on this rain seasons, and people always grow food in respect to the rain seasons. And this is...
Right, they don't have much access to irrigation
otherwise,
right?
Yes. So this is... this cuts across many countries, apart from countries like Egypt, which developed irrigation systems long time ago. Also parts of Ghana, South Africa. South Africa has four seasons, so it's not like other countries which you have two seasons. The production system in South Africa right. is a little bit different, and the varieties, the crops you find may be a little bit different from the countries in the...
What are your staple crops that you grow mostly?
In Uganda,
yeah,
the most common staple crops depend on the region of the country. In northern parts of the country, the staple is mainly sorghum, and beans and okra. When you go to the northeast, the staple crop, the most popular traditional and staple food is millet. The wild finger millet is the biggest crop grown in northeast. That is the Teso sub-region. And when you come to eastern Uganda, there is a lot of rice, which is the staple. This is now the flat land.
Right,
The plains in eastern Uganda, you have a lot of rice and potatoes and corn. In central and parts of western Uganda, the staple is bananas. A lot of bananas are grown in mixture with vanilla, with coffee, and other small scale crops like sweet potatoes. Mm-hmm. Southwest, the staple food in Southwest is potatoes and sorghum.
Uh-huh.
So this is the distribution of the staples. But the most produced food crop in Uganda is now bananas.
Bananas, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Now, we're almost out of time, but I would like to just touch on, if you can, for my listeners, what can they do from here in the United States to push policies that would help create change in Africa that would benefit the local people in an agricultural sense?
I would appeal to everyone to think about those policies which value small-scale activities in production, the policies which doesn't focus only on United States, the policies which don't focus on the boundaries of United States, but policies which focus on the betterment of the food system in the whole world, policies which focus on strengthening small-scale production activities worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And also the policies which will not promote a lot of dumping of American products to other to other
right,
countries.
Right.
So this, we have a very big problem with in Africa with dumping. You find a lot of supermarkets full of European dairy products, American meat, American
right.
beans, and these are frustrating small scale producers.
Right, and I've heard stories of us tying other types of aid to you accepting our food. And if you don't accept our food, we're going to cut the aid. And I've heard those kind of things that are really horrible. So, I just want to thank you so much for the work that you're doing. It's so important. And I had a similar feeling when I discovered Slow Food as a advocate for everything that revolves around good, healthy, and clean food. When I first discovered Slow Food, I thought, oh my God, there's an organization that believes in the things that I believe in. I remember just being so happy about that. And I know that you had a similar experience. So I just want to share with everyone out there, if you would like to participate in the 10,000 Gardens in Africa project, you can donate online at slowfoodusa.org. And if you want to read about Eddie, you can find out more information on the blog at slowfoodusa.org as well. And Eddie, thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you for this time.
You're welcome. And everybody out there, have a great rest of the week, and I'll be with you again next week. Bye for now.